Chapter 54. London. At that moment, a taxi braked to a halt in a driving rain outside a stubby, ivy-covered blockhouse beneath Admiralty Arch. The door opened, and a small, rather ugly man emerged, leaning heavily on a walking stick. He did not bother with an umbrella. It was only a few feet to the doorway, where a Royal Marine guard stood watch. The guard saluted smartly, which the ugly man did not bother returning, for it would have meant switching his stick from his right hand to his left, a troublesome task. Besides, 5 years after being commissioned as an officer in the Royal Navy, Arthur Braithwaite still was uncomfortable with the customs and traditions of military life. Officially, Braithwaite was not on duty for another hour, but as was his daily habit, he arrived at the Citadel 1 hour early to give himself more time to prepare. Braithwaite, crippled in one leg since childhood, knew that to succeed he always had to be better prepared than those around him. It was a commitment that had paid dividends. The submarine tracking room, down a warren of narrow, winding staircases, was not easily reached by a man with a badly deformed leg. He crossed the main trade plot and entered the tracking room through a guarded door. The energy and excitement of the place took hold of him immediately, just as it did every night. The windowless walls were the colour of clotted cream and covered with maps, charts and photographs of U-boats and their crews. Several dozen officers and typists worked at tables around the edges of the room. In the centre stood the main North Atlantic plotting table, where coloured pins depicted the location of every warship, freighter and submarine from the Baltic Sea to Cape Cod. A large photograph of Admiral Karl Dönitz, commander of the Kriegsmarine, glowered down from one wall. Braithwaite, as he did every morning, winked and said, "Good morning, Herr Admiral." Then he pushed back the door of his glass cubicle, removed his coat, and sat down at his desk. He reached for the stack of decodes that awaited him each morning, thinking, "A far cry from 1939, old son." Back in 1939 he had degrees in law and psychology from Cambridge and Yale, and was looking for something to do with them. When war broke out, he tried to put his fluent German to good use by volunteering to interrogate German POWs. So impressed were his superiors, they recommended a transfer to the Citadel, where he was assigned to the submarine tracking room as a civilian volunteer at the height of the Battle of the Atlantic. Braithwaite's intellect and drive quickly set him apart. He threw himself into his work, volunteered for extra duty, and read every book he could find on German naval history and tactics. Equipped with near-perfect recall, he memorized the biographies of every Kapitänleutnant of the U-Boot-Waffe. Within months, he developed a remarkable ability to forecast U-boat movements. None of this went unnoticed. He was given the rank of temporary commander and placed in charge of submarine tracking, a stunning achievement for someone who had not passed through the Dartmouth Naval College. His aide rapped on the glass door, waiting for Braithwaite's nod, and let himself inside. "Good morning, sir," he said, setting down a tray with a pot of tea and biscuits.
"Morning, Patrick."
"The weather kept things fairly quiet last night, sir. No U-boat surface sightings anywhere. The storm's moved off the western approaches. The east's bearing the brunt of it now, from Yorkshire to Suffolk." Braithwaite nodded, and the aide went out. The first items were conventional stuff, intercepts of routine communications between U-boats and BDU. The fifth caught his attention. It was an alert issued by a Major Alfred Vickery of the War Office. It said the authorities were pursuing two individuals, a man and a woman, who might be trying to leave the country. Braithwaite smiled at Vickery's guarded understatement. Vickery was obviously from MI5. The man and woman were obviously German agents of some kind, and whatever they were up to must be damned important. Otherwise the alert wouldn't have crossed his desk. He put Vickery's alert aside and continued reading. After a few more routine items, Braithwaite came upon something else that caught his attention. A wren at the Scarborough Y service station had intercepted what she believed was a communication between a U-boat and a wireless onshore. Huff Duff had pinpointed the transmitter to somewhere along the east coast, somewhere from Lincolnshire to Suffolk. Braithwaite pulled the item out of his stack and set it next to Vickery's alert. He rose and limped out of his office into the main room, stopping at the North Atlantic plotting table. Two members of his staff were repositioning some of the coloured pins to reflect overnight movements. Braithwaite seemed not to notice them. He fixed his gaze on the waters off Britain's east coast, face grave. After a moment, he said quietly,
"Patrick, bring me the file on U-509.
Chapter 55. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. Jenny reached the grove of pines at the base of the dunes and collapsed with exhaustion. She had run by instinct, like a frightened animal. She had stayed off the road, keeping instead to the meadows and the marshes, flooded with rain. She had fallen more times than she could remember. She was covered with mud, smelled of rotting earth and the sea. Her face, beaten by the rain and the wind, felt as if it had been slapped. And she was cold, colder than she had ever been in her life. Her oilskin felt as if it weighed 100 pounds. Her Wellington boots were filled with water. Her feet were freezing. Then she remembered she had run from the cottage with no socks. She fell to her hands and knees, gasping for breath. Her throat was raw and tasted of rust. She stayed that way for a moment until her breathing evened out, then forced herself to stand and enter the trees. It was pitch dark, so dark she had to walk with her hands outstretched before her, like a blind person groping through an unfamiliar place. She was cross with herself for not bringing her torch. The air was filled with the sound of the wind and the pounding of the breakers on the beach. The trees seemed to be in a familiar pattern now. Jenny walked by memory, like someone shuffling through their own home in the dark. The trees fell away. Her secret hiding place appeared before her. She slipped down the side and sat down with her back against the large rock. Overhead the pines writhed with the wind, but Jenny was sheltered from the worst of it. She wished she could make a fire, but the smoke would be visible from a long way off. She dug out her case from the bed of pine needles, took out the old woolen blanket, and wrapped herself tightly. The warmth took hold of her. Then she started to cry. She wondered how long she would have to wait here until going for help. 10 minutes? 20 minutes? A half hour? She wondered if Mary would still be at the cottage when she returned. She wondered if she would be hurt. A horrid vision of her father's dead body flashed before her eyes. She shook her head and tried to make it go away. She shivered, then clutched the blanket more tightly to her body. 30 minutes. She would wait 30 minutes. They would leave by then, and it would be safe to return. Neumann parked at the end of the track, grabbed his torch from the seat next to him and climbed out. He switched on the light and walked quickly through the trees. He scaled the dunes and scrambled down the other side. He switched off the torch as he walked across the beach to the water's edge. When he reached the flat, hard sand where the breakers met the beach, he broke into a light run, head down to push through the wind. He thought of the morning he was running on the beach and saw Jenny emerging from the dunes. He remembered how she looked, as though she had slept on the beach that night. He felt certain she had some kind of hiding place nearby where she went when things were bad at home. She was frightened, on the run, and alone. She would flee to the place she knew best, the way children do. Neumann went to the spot on the beach that served as his imaginary finish line, then stopped and walked toward the dunes. On the other side he switched on the torch, found a trampled footpath, and followed it. It led to a small depression, sheltered from the wind by the trees and a pair of large boulders. He shined his torch into the depression. The beam caught Jenny Colville's face.
"What's your real name?"
Jenny said as they drove back to the Doherty's cottage.
"My real name is Lieutenant Horst Neumann."
"Why do you speak English so well?"
"My father was English, and I was born in London. My mother and I moved to Germany when he died."
"Are you a German spy?"
"Something like that."
"What happened to Sean and my father?"
"We were using the radio in Sean's barn when your father burst in on us. Sean tried to stop him and your father killed him. Catherine and I killed your father." "I'm sorry, Jenny. It all happened very fast."
"Shut up! I don't want you to tell me you're sorry."
Neumann said nothing. Jenny said,
"What happens now?"
"We're going on a trip up the coast to the River Humber. From there we take a small boat out to sea to meet a U-boat."
"I hope they catch you, and I hope they kill you."
"I'd say that's a very distinct possibility."
"You're a bastard!"
Why did you get in that fight with my father over me?
Because I like you very much, Jenny Colville. I've lied to you about everything else, but that's the truth. Now just do exactly as I tell you and nothing bad will happen to you. Do you understand me?
Jenny nodded her head. Neumann turned into the Doherty's cottage. The door opened and Catherine came outside. She walked to the van and looked inside at Jenny. Then she looked at Neumann and said in German, "Tie her up and put her in the back. We're going to take her with us. You never know when a hostage might come in handy."
Neumann shook his head and replied in the same language. "Just leave her here. She's no use to us and she might get hurt."
"Are you forgetting I outrank you, Lieutenant?"
"No, Major," Neumann said, his voice tinged with sarcasm.
"Good. Now tie her up and let's get the hell out of this godforsaken place."
Neumann walked back to the barn to find a length of rope. He found some, picked up the lamp and started out. He took one last look at Sean Doherty's body, lying on the ground, covered by the old sacking. Neumann couldn't help but feel responsible for the chain of events that led to Sean's death. If he hadn't fought with Martin, Martin wouldn't have come to the barn with a shotgun tonight. Sean would be going with them to Germany, not lying on the floor of his barn with half his chest blown away. He doused the lamp, leaving the bodies in darkness, and went out, closing the door behind him. Jenny did not resist, nor did she speak a single word to him. Neumann bound her hands in front of her so she could sit more comfortably. He checked to make sure the knot was not too tight. Then he bound her feet. When he finished, he carried her to the rear of the van, opened the doors, and lifted her inside. He added another jerry can of petrol to the tank and tossed the empty container into the meadow. There was no sign of life on the track between the cottage and the village. Obviously, the gunshots had gone unnoticed in Hampton Sands. They crossed the bridge, swept past the spire of St. John's, and drove along the darkened street. The place was so quiet it might have been evacuated. Catherine sat next to him, silent, reloading her Mauser. Neumann opened the throttle, and Hampton Sands disappeared behind them. Chapter 56. London. Arthur Braithwaite's gaze settled on the plotting table while he waited for the file on U-509. Not that Braithwaite had much need for it. He thought he knew everything there was to know about the submarine's commanding officer and could probably recite every patrol the boat had ever made. He just wanted a couple of things confirmed before he telephoned MI5. U-509's movements had been puzzling him for weeks. The boat seemed to be on an aimless patrol of the North Sea, sailing nowhere in particular, going for long periods of time without contacting BDU. When it did check in, it reported a position off the British coastline near Spurn Head. It had also been spotted in aerial photographs at a U-boat pen in southern Norway. No surface sightings, no attacks on Allied warships or merchantmen. Braithwaite thought, "You're just lurking around out there up to nothing at all." "Well, I don't believe it, Captain Lieutenant Hoffmann." He looked up at the dour face of Dönitz and murmured, "Why would you let a perfectly good boat and crew go to waste like that?" The aide returned with the file a moment later. "Here we are, sir." Braithwaite didn't take the file. Instead, he began to recite the contents. "Captain's name is Max Hoffmann, if I remember correctly."
"Right, sir."
"Knight's Cross in 1942. Oak leaves a year later."
"Pinned on by the Führer himself."
"Now here's the important part. I believe he served on Canaris' staff at the Abwehr for a brief period before the war." The aide thumbed through the file.
"Yes, here it is, sir. Hoffmann was assigned to Abwehr headquarters in Berlin from 38 to 39. When war broke out, he was given command of U-509.
Braithwaite was staring at the map table again. "Patrick, if you had an important German spy who needed a lift out of Britain, wouldn't you prefer to have an old friend do the driving?"
"Indeed, sir."
"Ring Vickery at MI5. I think we'd better have a chat."
Chapter 57. London. Alfred Vickery was standing before an 8-foot-high map of the British Isles, chain-smoking, drinking wretched tea, and thinking, Now I know how Adolf Hitler must feel. Based on the telephone call from Commander Lowe at the Y service station in Scarborough, it was now safe to assume the spies were trying to slip out of England aboard a U-boat. But Vickery had one very simple yet very serious problem. He had only a vague idea of when, and an even vaguer idea of where. He assumed the spies had to meet the submarine before dawn. It would be too dangerous for a U-boat to remain on the surface near the coast after first light. It was possible the U-boat might put a landing party ashore in a rubber dinghy. That's how the Abwehr inserted many of its spies into Britain, but Vickery doubted they would attempt to do so in heavy seas. Stealing a boat was not as easy as it sounded. The Royal Navy had seized almost everything that could float. Fishing in the North Sea had dwindled because coastal waters were heavily mined. A pair of spies on the run would have a difficult time finding a seaworthy craft on short notice in a storm in the blackout. He thought, perhaps the spies already have a boat. The more vexing question was where. From what point along the coastline would they put to sea? Vickery stared at the map. The Y service could not pinpoint the exact location of the transmitter. Vickery, for argument's sake, would choose the precise center of the large area they had given him. He traced his finger along the map until he came to the Norfolk coast. Yes, it made perfect sense. Vickery knew his railway timetables. A spy could hide in one of the villages along the coast and still be in London in 3 hours' time because of the direct train service from Hunstanton. Vickery assumed they had a good vehicle and plenty of petrol. They had already travelled a substantial distance from London, and because of the heavy police presence on the railways, he was virtually certain they had not done it by train. So how far from the Norfolk coast could they possibly travel before getting into a boat and heading out to sea? The U-boat would probably come no closer to shore than about 5 miles. It would take the spies at least an hour to sail 5 miles out to sea, if not more. If the U-boat submerged at first light, the spies would have to set sail no later than about 6 a.m. to be on the safe side. The radio message was sent at 10 p.m. That left them 8 hours of potential driving time. How far could they travel? Given the weather, the blackout, and the poor road conditions, 100 to 150 miles. Vickery looked at the map, dejected. That still left a huge swath of the British coast, stretching from the Thames estuary in the south to the river Humber in the north. It would be nearly impossible to cover it all. The coastline was dotted with small ports, fishing villages and quays. Vickery had asked the local police forces to cover the coast with as many men as they could. RAF Coastal Command had agreed to fly search missions at first light, even though Vickery feared that was too late. Royal Navy corvettes were watching for small craft, even though it would be nearly impossible to spot them on a rainy, moonless night at sea. Without another lead, a second intercepted radio signal or a sighting, there was little hope of catching them. The telephone rang. Vickery!
This is Commander Arthur Braithwaite at the submarine tracking room. I saw your alert when I arrived on duty, and I think I may be of some rather serious help.
The submarine tracking room says U-509 has been moving in and out of the waters off the Lincolnshire coast for a couple of weeks now, Vickery said. Boothby had come downstairs and joined Vickery's vigil in front of the map. If we pour our men and resources into Lincolnshire, we stand a good chance of stopping them.
It's still a lot of coastline to cover.
Vickery was looking at the map again.
What's the largest town up there?
Grimsby, I'd say.
How appropriate. Grimsby. How long do you think it would take me to get up there?
Transport section could arrange a lift for you, but it would take hours.
Vickery grimaced. Transport maintained a few fast cars for cases just like this. There were expert drivers on standby who specialized in high-speed chases. A couple of them had even competed in professional races before the war. Vickery thought the drivers, while brilliant, were too reckless. He remembered the night he pulled the spy off the beach in Cornwall, remembered barreling through the blacked-out Cornish night in the back of a souped-up Rover, praying he would live long enough to make the arrest. Vickery said,
"How about an airplane?" "I'm sure I could arrange a lift for you from the RAF. There's a small fighter command base outside Grimsby. They could have you up there in an hour or so, and you could use the base as your command post.
But have you taken a look out the window lately? It's a god-awful night for flying.
I realize that, but I'm certain I could do a better job coordinating the search if I was on the ground there. The vicary turned from the map and looked at Boothby.
And there's something else that's occurred to me. If we're able to stop them before they send Berlin a message, perhaps I can send it for them.
Devise some explanation for their decision to flee London that bolsters the belief in Kettledrum?
Exactly.
Good thinking, Alfred.
I'd like to take a couple of men with me. Roach, Dalton, if he's up to it. Boothby hesitated.
I think you should take one other person.
Who?
Peter Jordan.
Jordan?
Look at it from the other side of the looking-glass. If Jordan has been deceived and betrayed, wouldn't he want to be there at the end to watch Catherine Blake's demise?
I know I certainly would. I'd want to pull the trigger myself, if I were in his shoes.
And the Germans have to think that, too. We have to do anything we can to make them believe in the illusion of Kettledrum.
Vickery thought of the empty file in registry. The telephone rang again.
Vickery.
It was one of the department operators.
Professor Vickery, I have a trunk call from Chief Superintendent Perkin of the King's Lynn Police in Norfolk. He says it's quite urgent.
Put him through.
Hampton Sands was too small, too isolated, and too quiet to warrant its own police constable. It shared one constable with four other Norfolk coast villages, Holme, Thornton, Titchwell, and Brancaster. The constable was a man named Thomason, a police veteran who had worked the Norfolk coast since the last war. Thomason lived in a police house in Brancaster, and because of the requirements of his work, had his own telephone. 1 hour earlier, the telephone had rung, waking Thomason, his wife, and his English setter, Rags. The voice at the other end of the line was Chief Superintendent Perkin from King's Lynn. The superintendent told Thomason about the urgent telephone call he had received from the War Office in London, asking for assistance from local police forces in the search for two fugitive murder suspects. 10 minutes after receiving Perkin's telephone call, Thomason was letting himself out the door of the cottage, wearing a blue oilskin cape and a sou'wester knotted beneath his chin, and carrying a flask of sweet tea Judith had quickly made for him. He pushed his bicycle around from the shed at the back of the house, then set off toward the center of the village. Rags, who always accompanied Thomason on his rounds, trotted easily next to him. Thomason was in his mid-50s. He never smoked, rarely touched alcohol, and 30 years of cycling the rolling coastline of Norfolk had left him fit and very strong. His thick, well-muscled legs pumped easily, propelling the heavy iron bicycle into Brancaster. As he suspected, the village was dead quiet. He could knock on a few doors, wake a few people up, but he knew everyone in the village, and none of them were housing fugitive murderers. He took one pass through the silent streets, then turned onto the coast road and pedalled toward the next village, Hampton Sands. The Colville cottage was about a quarter mile outside the village. Everyone knew about Martin Colville. He had been deserted by his wife, was a heavy drinker, and barely scratched a living from his smallholding. Thomason knew Colville was too hard on his daughter, Jenny. He also knew Jenny spent a great deal of time in the dunes. Thomason had found her things after one of the locals complained about tinkers living on the beach. He coasted to a stop and shined his torch toward the Colville cottage. It was dark, and there was no smoke coming from the chimney. Thomason pushed his bike up the drive and knocked on the door. There was no answer. Fearing Colville could be drunk or passed out, he knocked again harder. Again, no answer. He pushed the door open and looked inside. The interior was dark. He called Colville's name one last time. Hearing no answer, he left the cottage and continued on into Hampton Sands. Hampton Sands, like Brancaster, was quiet and blacked out. Thomason cycled through the village, past the Arms, the village store, and St. John's Church. He crossed the bridge over the Sea Creek. Sean and Mary Doherty lived about a mile outside the village. Thomason knew that Jenny Colville practically lived with the Dohertys. It was very likely she was spending the night there. But where was Martin? It was a difficult mile, the track rising and falling beneath him. Ahead of him, in the darkness, he could hear the click of Rags's paws on the track and the steady rhythm of his breathing. The Doherty cottage appeared before him. He pedalled up to the drive, stopped,
and shined his torch back and forth. Something in the meadow caught his attention. He played the beam of light across the grass, and there it was again. He waded forward into the saturated meadow and reached down for the object. It was an empty jerry can. He sniffed. Petrol. He turned it upside down. A thread of fuel trickled out. Rags walked ahead of him toward the Doherty cottage. He saw Sean Doherty's dilapidated old van parked in the yard. Then he spotted a pair of bicycles lying in the grass beside the barn. Thomason walked to the cottage and knocked on the door. Like the Colville cottage, there was no answer. Thomason didn't bother knocking a second time. He was by now thoroughly alarmed by what he had seen. He pushed back the door and called out, "Hello?" He heard a strange sound, a muffled grunting. He shone his torch into the room and saw Mary Doherty tied to a chair, a gag around her mouth. Thomason rushed forward, Rags barking furiously, and quickly untied the cloth around her face.
"Mary, what in God's name happened here?"
Mary, hysterical, gasped for air.
"Sean! Martin! Dead! Barn! Spies! Submarine! Jenny!"
"Vickery here. Chief Superintendent Perkin of the King's Lynn Police. What have you got? 2 dead bodies, a hysterical woman, and a missing girl."
"My God! Start from the beginning."
"After I received your call, I sent all my constables out on rounds. Police Constable Thomason handles a handful of small villages along the North Norfolk coast. He found the trouble."
"Go on."
"It happened in a place called Hampton Sands. Unless you have a large map, you're not likely to find it. If you do, find Hunt Stanton on the Wash and trace your finger east along the Norfolk coast and you'll see Hampton Sands."
"I've got it."
It was nearly the spot where Vickery guessed the transmitter might be.
"Thomason found 2 bodies in a barn on a farm just outside Hampton Sands. The victims are both local men, Martin Colville and Sean Doherty. Doherty's an Irishman. Thomason found Doherty's wife, Mary, bound and gagged in the cottage. She'd been hit on the head and was hysterical when Thomason discovered her. She told him quite a tale."
"Nothing will surprise me, Superintendent. Please continue."
"Mrs. Doherty says her husband has been spying for the Germans since the beginning of the war. He was never a full-fledged IRA gunman, but he had ties to the group. She says a couple of weeks ago the Germans dropped another agent onto the beach named Horst Neumann, and Doherty took him in. The agent has been living with them ever since and travelling regularly to London."
"What happened tonight?"
"She's not sure exactly. She heard gunshots, ran outside to the barn and found the bodies. The German told her that Colville burst in on them, and that's when the shooting started."
"Was there a woman with Neumann?"
"Yes."
"Tell me about the missing girl."
"Colville's daughter, Jenny. She's not at home, and her bicycle was found at the Doherty's. Thomason speculates she followed her father, witnessed the shooting, or the aftermath, and fled. Mary is afraid the Germans found the girl and took her with them."
"Does she know where they were headed?"
"No. But she says they're driving a van. Black, perhaps."
"Where is she now?"
"Still at the cottage."
"Where's Constable Thomason?"
"He's still on the line from a public house in Hampton Sands."
"Was there any sign of a radio in the cottage or the barn?"
"Hold on, let me ask him."
Vickery could hear Perkin, voice muffled, ask the question.
"He says he saw a contraption in the barn that could be a radio."
"What did it look like?"
"A suitcase filled with something that looked like a wireless. It was destroyed by a shotgun blast."
"Who else knows about this?"
"Me, Thomason, and probably the landlord at the public house. I suspect he's standing next to Thomason right now."
"I want you to tell absolutely no one else about what happened at the Doherty cottage tonight. There is to be no mention of German agents in any report on this affair. This is a security matter of the utmost importance. Is that clear, Superintendent?"
"I understand."
"I'm going to send a team of my men to Norfolk to assist you. For now, leave Mary Doherty and those bodies exactly where they are."
"Yes, sir."
Vickery was looking at the map again.
"Now, Superintendent, I have information that leads me to suspect those fugitives are in all likelihood heading directly your way. We believe their ultimate destination is the Lincolnshire coast."
"I've called in all my men. We're blocking all the major roads."
Keep this office informed of every development, and good luck.
Vickery rang off and turned to Boothby.
They've killed two people. They probably have a hostage, and they're making a run for the Lincolnshire coast.
Vickery smiled wolfishly.
And it looks as though they've just lost their second radio.
Chapter 58. Lincolnshire, England. 2 hours after leaving Hampton Sands, Horst Neumann and Catherine Blake were beginning to have serious doubts about their chances of making the rendezvous with the submarine in time. To escape the Norfolk coast, Neumann retraced his course, climbing into the cluster of hills in the heart of Norfolk, then following thin ribbons of road through the heathland and the darkened villages. He skirted King's Lynn to the southeast, wound his way through a series of hamlets, and then crossed the River Great Ouse at a village called Wiganhall St. Germans. The journey across the southern edge of the Wash was a nightmare. Wind poured in from the North Sea and whipped over the marshes and the dikes. The rain increased. Sometimes it came in irate squalls, swirling, wind-blown, erasing the edges of the road. Neumann hunched forward, mile after mile, gripping the wheel with both hands as the van raced across the flat terrain. At times he had the sensation of floating through an abyss. Catherine sat next to him, reading Doherty's old ordnance survey map by the light of her torch. They spoke in German so that Jenny could not understand. Neumann found Catherine's German odd, flat, toneless, no regional accent, the kind of German that is a second or third language, the kind of German that has not been used in a very long time. Neumann, with Catherine navigating, plotted his course. Cleethorpes, where their boat was waiting for them, lay next to the port of Grimsby, at the mouth of the Humber. Once they were clear of the Wash, there were no large towns standing in their way. According to the maps, there was a good road, the A16, that ran several miles inland along the base of the Lincolnshire Wolds, then to the Humber. For purposes of planning, Neumann assumed the worst. He assumed that Mary would eventually be found, that MI5 would eventually be alerted, and roadblocks would be thrown up on all major roads near the coastline. He would take the A16 halfway toward Cleethorpes, then switch to a smaller road that ran closer to the coast. Boston lay near the western shore of the Wash. It was the last large town standing between them and the Humber. Neumann left the main road, crept through quiet side streets, then rejoined the A16 north of town. He opened the throttle and pushed the van hard through the storm. Catherine switched off the blackout torch and watched the rain swirling in the soft glow of the headlamps. "What's it like now, in Berlin?" Neumann kept his eyes on the road. "It's paradise. We are all happy. We work hard in the factories. We shake our fists at the American and British bombers, and everyone loves the Führer." "You sound like one of Goebbels' propaganda films."
"The truth isn't quite so entertaining. Berlin is very bad. The Americans come with their B-17s by day, and the British come with their Lancasters and Halifaxes at night. Some days it seems the city is under almost constant bombardment. Most of central Berlin is a pile of rubble."
"Having lived through the Blitz myself, I'm afraid Germany deserves whatever the Americans and British can dish out. The Germans were the first to take the war to the civilian population. I can't shed many tears because Berlin is now being pounded into dust."
"You sound like a Brit yourself."
"I am half British. My mother was English, and I've been living among the British for 6 years. It's not hard to forget whose side you're supposed to be on when you're in a situation like that. But tell me more about Berlin."
"Those with money or connections manage to eat well. Those without money or connections don't. The Russians have turned the tables in the east. I suspect half of Berlin is hoping the invasion succeeds so the Americans can get to Berlin before the Ivans."
"So typically German. They elect a psychopath, give him absolute power, then cry because he's led them to the brink of destruction."
Neumann laughed. "If you were blessed with such foresight, why in the world did you volunteer to become a spy?"
"Who said anything about volunteering?" They flashed through a pair of villages, first Stickney, then Stickford. The scent of wood smoke from fires burning in the cottages penetrated the interior of the van. Neumann heard a dog barking, then another. He reached in his pocket,
removed his cigarettes and gave them to Catherine. She lit two, kept one for herself, and handed one back to him.
"Would you like to explain that last remark?"
She thought, "Would I?" It felt terribly strange, after all these years, even to be speaking in German. She had spent 6 years hiding every shred of truth about herself. She had become someone else, erased every aspect of her personality and her past. When she thought about the person she was before Hitler and before the war, it was as if she were thinking about someone else.
"Anna Katharina von Steiner died in an unfortunate road accident outside Berlin."
"Well, I didn't exactly go down to the local Abwehr office and sign up," she said. "But then I don't suppose anyone in this line of work gets their job that way, do they? They always come for you. In my case, they was Kurt Vogel." She told him the story, the story she had never told another person before. The story of the summer in Spain, the summer the Civil War broke out. The summer at Maria's estancia. Her affair with Maria's father. "Just my luck, he turns out to be a fascist and a talent spotter for the Abwehr. He sells me to Vogel, and Vogel comes looking for me."
"Why didn't you just say no?"
"Why didn't any of us just say no? In my case, he threatened the one thing in this world I care most about, my father. That's what a good case officer does. They get inside your head. They get to know how you think, how you feel, what you love and what you fear. And then they use it to make you do whatever they want you to do." She smoked quietly for a moment, watching as they passed through another village. "He knew that I lived in London when I was a child, that I spoke the language perfectly, that I already knew how to handle a weapon, and that..." Silence for a moment. Neumann didn't press her. He just waited, fascinated. "He knew that I had a personality suited to the assignment he had in mind. I've been in Britain nearly 6 years, alone, with virtually no contact with anyone from my side. No friends, no family, no contact with any other agents. Nothing. It was more like a prison sentence than an assignment. I can't tell you how many times I dreamed about going back to Berlin and killing Vogel with one of the wonderful techniques he and his friends taught me."
"How did you enter the country?"
She told him what Vogel made her do.
"Jesus Christ," Neumann muttered.
"Something the Gestapo would do, right? I spent the next month preparing my new identity. Then I settled in and waited. Vogel and I had a way of communicating over the wireless that didn't involve code names. So the British never looked for me. Vogel knew I was safe and in place, ready to be activated. Then the idiot gives me one assignment and sends me straight into the arms of MI5. She laughed quietly. "My God, I can't believe I'm actually going back there after all this time. I never thought I would see Germany again."
"You don't sound terribly thrilled about the prospect of going home."
"Home? It's hard to think of Germany as my home. It's hard to think of myself as German. Vogel erased that part of me at his wonderful little mountain retreat in Bavaria."
"What are you going to do?"
"Meet with Vogel, make certain my father is still alive, then collect my payment and leave. Vogel can create another one of his false identities for me. I can pass for about 5 different nationalities. That's what landed me in the game to begin with. It's all a big game, isn't it? One big game."
"Where are you going to go?"
"Back to Spain," she said. "Back to the place where it all started."
"Tell me about it," Neumann said. "I need to think about something besides this godforsaken road."
"It's in the foothills of the Pyrenees. In the morning we go hunting, and in the afternoon we ride up into the mountains. There's a wonderful stream with deep, cold pools, and we stay there all afternoon, drinking icy white wine and smelling the eucalyptus trees. I used to think about it all the time when the loneliness got to me. I thought I was going to go crazy sometimes."
"It sounds wonderful. If you need a stable hand, let me know."
She looked at him and smiled. "You've been wonderful. If it weren't for you..." She hesitated. "God, I can't even imagine."
"Don't mention it. Glad I could be of assistance. I don't mean to rain on our parade, but we're not out of danger yet."
Believe me, I realize that.
She finished her cigarette, opened the window a crack, and tossed the butt into the night. It hit the roadway and exploded into sparks. She sat back and closed her eyes. She had been running on adrenaline and fear for too long. Exhaustion stalked her. The gentle rocking of the van lulled her into a light half-sleep. Neumann said, "Fogel never told me your real name. What is it?"
"My real name was Anna Katharina von Steiner," she said, sleep creeping into her voice. "But I would prefer it if you continue to call me Catherine. You see, Kurt Fogel killed Anna before he sent her to England. I'm afraid Anna no longer exists. Anna is dead."
Neumann's voice, when he spoke again, was far away, at the end of a long tunnel. "How did a beautiful and intelligent woman like Anna Katharina von Steiner end up here, like this?"
"That's a very good question," she said,
and then fatigue overtook her, and she was asleep. The dream is her only memory of it. It was driven benevolently from her conscious thoughts long ago. She sees it now in flash bursts, stolen glimpses. Sometimes she sees it with her own eyes, as though she is reliving it, and sometimes the dream makes her watch it again like a spectator in a grandstand. Tonight she is reliving it. She is lying beside the lake. Papa lets her go alone. He knows she will not go near the water. It is too chilly for swimming, and he knows she likes to be by herself to think about her mother. It is autumn. She has brought a blanket. The tall grass at the edge of the lake is damp with the morning's rain. The wind moves in the trees. A flock of rooks scatter and wheel noisily overhead. The trees weep flaming leaves of orange and red. She watches the leaves float gently downward, like tiny hot air balloons, and settle on the rippled surface of the lake. It is then, as her eye follows the descent of the leaves, that she sees the man, standing in the trees across the lake. He is very still for a long time, watching her. Then he moves toward her. He is wearing knee-high boots and a thigh-length coat. A shotgun, broken at the breech, is cradled over his right arm. His hair and beard are too long. His eyes are red and damp. As he moves closer, she can see something hanging from his belt. She realizes it is a pair of bloody rabbits. Limp with death, they seem absurdly long and thin. Papa has a word for men like him. Poachers. They come onto other people's land and kill the animals. Deer and rabbit and pheasant. She thinks it is a funny word, poachers. It sounds like someone who prepares eggs in the morning. She thinks about that now as he approaches, and it makes her smile. The poacher asks if he can sit next to her, and she tells him yes. He squats and lays the shotgun in the grass.
"Are you here alone?"
he asks.
"Yes, my father says it's all right."
"Where is your father now?"
"He's in the house."
"And he's not coming here?"
"No."
"I want to show you something," he says. "Something that will make you feel wonderful."
His eyes are very damp now. He is smiling. His teeth are black and rotten. She becomes frightened for the first time. She tries to stand up, but he grabs her by the shoulders and forces her down onto the blanket. She tries to scream, but he smothers the sound with a big hairy hand. Suddenly, he is on top of her. She is paralyzed beneath the weight of him. He is reaching up her dress and pulling at her underwear. The pain is like nothing she has ever felt. She feels she is being ripped apart. He pins her arms behind her head with one hand and covers her mouth with the other so no one will hear her scream. She feels the still warm bodies of the dead rabbits pressing against her leg. Then the poacher's face becomes contorted, as if he is in pain, and it stops as suddenly as it began. He is talking to her again.
"You saw the rabbits. You saw what I did to the rabbits."
She tries to nod, but the hand over her mouth is pressing so hard she cannot move her head.
"If you ever tell anyone about what happened here today, I'll do the same to you. And then I'll do it to your father. I'll shoot you both, and then I'll hang your heads from my belt. Do you hear me, girl?
She starts to cry.
You're a very bad girl, he says. Oh, yes, I can see that. I think you actually liked it.
Then he does it to her again. The shaking starts. She has never dreamed it this way before. Someone is calling her name.
Catherine! Catherine! Wake up!
Why is he calling me Catherine? My name is Anna.
Horst Neumann shook her once more, violently, and shouted,
Catherine, damn it! Wake up! We're in trouble!
Chapter 59. Lincolnshire, England. It was 3 a.m. when the Lysander broke through the thick clouds and bumped to a landing at the small RAF base 2 miles outside the town of Grimsby. Alfred Vickery had never flown in an airplane, and it was not an experience he wished to repeat soon. The heavy weather tossed the plane during the entire flight from London, and as they taxied toward the small operations hut, Vickery was never so glad to see any place in all his life. The pilot shut down the engine while a crewman opened the cabin door. Vickery, Harry Dalton, Clive Roach, and Peter Jordan quickly climbed down. 2 men were waiting for them, a young, square-shouldered RAF officer and a bluff, pockmarked man in a dilapidated raincoat. The RAF man stuck out his hand and handled the introductions.
Squadron Leader Edmund Hughes. This is Chief Superintendent Roger Lockwood of the Lincolnshire County Constabulary. Come inside the operations hut. It's crude, but dry, and we've set up a makeshift command post for you.
They went inside.
The RAF officer said, I suppose it's not as nice as your digs in London.
You'd be surprised, Vickery said.
It was a small room with a window overlooking the airfield. A large-scale map of Lincolnshire was tacked up on one wall, a desk with a pair of battered telephones opposite.
It will do just fine.
We have a wireless and a teleprinter, Hughes said. We even can manage some tea and cheese sandwiches. You look as though you could use something to eat.
Thank you, Vickery said. It's been a long day.
Hughes went out, and Chief Superintendent Lockwood stepped forward.
We've got men on every major road between here and the Wash, Lockwood said, his thick finger jabbing at the map. In the smallest villages, they're just constables on bicycles, so I'm afraid they won't be able to do much if they spot them. But as they move closer to the coast, they'll be in trouble. Roadblocks here, 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 and here. My best men, patrol cars, vans, and weapons.
Very good. What about the coastline itself?
I've got a man on every dock and quay along the Lincolnshire coast and the Humber. If they try to steal a boat, I'll know about it.
What about the open beaches?
That's another story. I don't have unlimited resources. I lost a lot of my good lads to the army, same as everybody else. I know these waters. I'm an amateur seaman myself, and I wouldn't want to head out to sea tonight in any boat I could launch from a beach. This weather may be the best friend we've got.
Aye. One other thing, Major Vickery. Do we still need to pretend these are just a pair of ordinary criminals you're after?
Actually, Chief Superintendent, we do indeed.
The junction of the A-16 and a smaller B-road lay just outside the town of Louth. Neumann had planned to leave the A-16 at that point, take the B-road to the coast, turn onto another secondary road, and head north to Cleethorpes. There was just one problem. Half the police in Louth were standing in the junction. Neumann could see at least 4 men. As he approached, they shone their torches in his direction and waved for him to stop. Catherine was awake now, startled.
What's going on?
End of the line, I'm afraid, Neumann said, bringing the van to a halt. They've obviously been waiting for us. No talking our way out of this.
Catherine picked up her Mauser.
Who said anything about talking?
One of the constables stepped forward, carrying a shotgun, and rapped on Neumann's window. Neumann wound down the window and said,
Good evening. What's the problem?
Mind stepping out of the van, sir?
Actually, I do. It's late. I'm tired. The weather's dreadful, and I want to get where I'm going.
And where would that be, sir?
Kingston, Neumann said, though he could see the constable was already doubting his story.
Another constable appeared at Catherine's window. Two more took up positions behind the van. The policeman pulled open Neumann's door, leveled the shotgun at his face and said,
"All right, put your hands up where I can see them and get out of the van. Nice and slow."
Jenny Colville sat in the back of the darkened van, hands and feet bound, mouth gagged, her wrists hurt. So did her neck and her back. She had been sitting on the floor of the van for how long? 2 hours? 3 hours? Maybe four? When the van slowed, she allowed herself a brief flash of hope. She thought, maybe this will all be over soon, and I can go back to Hampton Sands, and Mary and Sean and Dad will be there, and things will be like they used to be before he came, and it will all turn out to be a bad dream, and... She stopped herself. Better to be realistic. Better to think about what was really possible. She watched them in the front seat. They had spoken softly in German for a long time. Then the woman fell asleep, and now Neumann was shaking her and trying to wake her up. Ahead, through the windscreen, she saw light, beams of light, bouncing back and forth, like torches. She thought police officers would carry torches if they were blocking the road. Was it possible? Did they know that they were German spies and that she had been kidnapped? Were they looking for her? The van stopped. She could see two policemen in front of the van, and outside, near the back of the van, she could hear the footfalls and voices of at least two more. She heard the policeman tap on the glass. She saw Neumann wind down his window. She saw that he had a gun in his hand. Jenny looked at the woman. She had a gun in her hand, too. Then she remembered what happened in the barn. Two people got in their way, her father and Sean Docherty, and they had killed them both. It was possible they had killed Mary, too. They weren't going to surrender just because some country policeman told them to. They would kill the policeman, too, just like they killed her father and Sean. Jenny heard the door open, heard the police officer yelling at them to get out. She knew what was about to happen. Instead of getting out, they would start shooting. Then the policemen would all be dead, and Jenny would be alone with them again. She had to warn them. But how? She couldn't speak because Neumann had gagged her mouth so tightly. She could do only one thing. She raised her legs and kicked the side of the van as hard as she could. If Jenny Colville's action did not have its intended effect, it did grant at least one of the officers, the one standing nearest Catherine Blake's door, a more benevolent death. When he turned his head toward the sound, Catherine raised her Mauser and shot him. The Mauser's superb silencer damped the explosion of the round so that the gun emitted only a tense burst. The bullet smashed through the window, struck the constable at the hinge of his jaw, then ricocheted into the base of his brain. He collapsed onto the muddy apron of the road, dead. The second to die was the constable at Neumann's door, though Neumann did not fire the shot that killed him. Neumann knocked the shotgun away with a sweep of his right hand. Catherine turned and fired through the open door. The bullet struck the constable in the center of the forehead and exited at the back of his skull. He fell back onto the roadway. Neumann tumbled from the door and landed in the road. One of the officers at the rear of the van fired over his head, shattering the half-open window. Neumann quickly squeezed the trigger twice. The first shot struck the constable in the shoulder, spinning him around. The second pierced his heart. Catherine stepped from the van, the gun in her outstretched hands aimed into the darkness. On the other side of the van, Neumann was doing the same thing, only was still lying flat on his stomach. Both waited, making no sound, listening. The fourth constable thought it best to flee for help. He turned and started running into the darkness. After a few steps, he came into Neumann's range. Neumann took careful aim and fired twice. The running stopped, the shotgun clattered on the tarmac, and the last of the four men fell to the rainy roadway, dead. Neumann collected the bodies and stacked them at the back of the van. Catherine opened the rear doors. Jenny, eyes wide with terror, raised her hands to cover her head. Catherine lifted the gun into the air and struck Jenny's face. A deep gash opened over her eye. Catherine said, "Unless you want to end up like them, don't ever try anything like that again." Neumann lifted Jenny and laid her on the apron of the road. Then, together with Catherine, he placed the bodies of the dead constables in the back of the van. The idea had come to him immediately. The police officers had travelled to this spot in their own van. It was parked a few yards away on the side of the road.
Neumann would hide the bodies and the stolen van out of sight in the trees and use the police van to drive to the coast. It might be hours before any other policeman came here and discovered the constables were missing. By then, he and Catherine would be heading back to Germany aboard the U-boat. Neumann carried Jenny and placed her in the back of the police van. Catherine climbed into the driver's seat and started the motor. Neumann walked back to the other van and got inside. The engine was running. He reversed and turned around, then sped down the road, Catherine following. He tried not to think about the four dead bodies lying just inches from him. 2 minutes later, Neumann turned into a small track leading off the road. He drove about 200 yards, stopped, and shut down the motor. Then he climbed out and ran back to the road. Catherine had turned the van around and was sitting in the passenger seat when Neumann returned. He climbed in, slammed the door, and sped away. They passed the spot where the roadblock had been and turned onto the smaller B road. According to the map, it was about 10 miles to the coast road, then another 20 miles to Cleethorpes. Neumann opened the throttle and pushed the van hard. For the first time since spotting the MI5 men in London, he allowed himself to imagine they just might make it after all. Alfred Vickery paced in his room at the RAF base outside Grimsby. Harry Dalton and Peter Jordan sat at the desk, smoking. Superintendent Lockwood sat next to them, arranging matches into geometric shapes. Vickery said, "I don't like it. Someone should have spotted them by now." Harry said, "All the major roads are sealed. They have to hit one of the roadblocks at some point. Maybe they're not coming this way after all. Maybe I've made a dreadful miscalculation. Maybe they went south from Hampton Sands. Maybe the signal to the U-boat was a ploy, and they're heading to Ireland on a ferry. They're coming this way. Maybe they've gone to ground, called it off. Maybe they're holed up in another remote village, waiting for it all to blow over before they make their move. They've signaled the submarine. They have to go. They don't have to do anything. It's possible they've spotted the roadblocks and the extra police about and decided to wait. They can signal the submarine at the next opportunity and try again when things have quieted down." "You're forgetting one thing. They don't have a radio." "We think they don't have a radio. You took one from them, and Thomason found a destroyed radio in Hampton Sands, but we don't know for certain they don't have a third." "We don't know anything for certain, Alfred. We make educated guesses." Vickery paced, looking at the telephone, thinking, "Ring, damn it, ring!" Desperate to do something, he picked up the receiver and asked the operator to connect him to the submarine tracking room in London. Arthur Braithwaite, when he finally came on the line, sounded like he was inside a torpedo tube. Vickery asked, "Anything, Commander?"
"I've spoken with the Royal Navy and the local Coast Guard. The Royal Navy is moving a pair of corvettes into the area as we speak, numbers 745 and 128. They'll be off Spurnhead within the hour and will commence search operations immediately. The Coast Guard is handling things closer to shore. The RAF is putting up planes at first light."
"When is that?"
"Around 7 a.m. Maybe a little later because of the dense cloud cover."
"That may be too late."
"It won't do them any good to go up before then. They need light to see. They'd be as good as blind if they went up now. There is some good news. We expect a break in the weather shortly before dawn. The cloud cover will remain, but the rain is expected to ease and the winds diminish. That will make it easier to conduct search operations."
"I'm not sure that's such good news after all. We were counting on the storm to bottle up the coast, and better weather will make it easier for the agents and the U-boat to operate as well."
"Point well taken."
"Instruct the Royal Navy and the RAF to conduct the search as discreetly as possible. I know it sounds far-fetched, but try to make it all look routine. And tell everyone to mind what they say on their radios. The Germans listen to us, too."
"I'm sorry I can't be more forthcoming, Commander Braithwaite."
"I understand. I'll pass it up the line."
"Thank you."
"And try to relax, Major Vickery. If your spies try to reach that submarine tonight, we'll stop them."
Police constables Gardner and Sullivan pedaled side by side through the dark streets of Louth. Gardner, big, bluff, and middle-aged. Sullivan, thin and fit and barely 20 years old.
Chief Superintendent Lockwood had ordered them to ride to a roadblock just south of the village and relieve two of the constables there. Gardner complained as he cycled.
"Why do London's criminals always manage to end up here in the middle of a rainstorm? Would you tell me that?"
Sullivan was thoroughly excited. This was his first big manhunt. It was also the first time he had carried a weapon while on duty. A 30-year-old bolt-action rifle from the weapons room at the station was slung over his shoulder. 5 minutes later, they arrived at the junction where the roadblock was supposed to be. The place was deserted. Gardner stood, legs astride the frame of his bike. Sullivan laid down his bike, broke out his torch, and shone it over the area. First he saw the tire marks, then the shattered glass. Sullivan shouted, "Over here! Quick!" Gardner climbed off his bike and pushed it over to where Sullivan was standing.
"Christ almighty! Look at the tracks! Two vehicles! The one they were driving, and ours! When they turned around, the tires were muddied on the apron of the road. They've left us a nice set of tracks to follow."
"Aye. You see where they lead. I'll ride back to the station and alert Lockwood, and for heaven's sake, be careful!"
Sullivan pedaled along the road, holding his torch in one hand, watching the tracks gradually fade away. 100 yards after leaving the site of the roadblock, the trail was gone. Sullivan rode for another quarter mile, looking for any sign of the police van. He rode a little farther and then spotted another set of tire tracks. These were different. The tracks became more clear and defined the farther he pedaled. The vehicle that made them had obviously come from the other direction. He followed the tracks to their point of origin and found the small path leading into the trees. He turned his torch down the path and saw the pair of fresh tire tracks. He turned the beam horizontally down the tunnel of trees, but the light was not powerful enough to penetrate the darkness. He looked at the track, too rutted and muddy to handle his bike. He climbed off, leaned the bike against the tree, and started walking. 2 minutes later, he spotted the back of the van. He called out, but there was no reply. He looked more closely. It was not the police vehicle. It had London plates and was a different model. Sullivan moved forward slowly. He approached the front of the van from the passenger side and shone his torch inside. The front seat was empty. He turned the beam toward the storage area at the back. It was then he spotted the bodies. Sullivan left the van in the trees and rode back to Louth, pedaling as fast as he could. He arrived at the police station and quickly raised Chief Superintendent Lockwood at the RAF base.
"All four of them are dead," he said, out of breath from the ride. "They're lying in the back of a van, but it's not theirs. The fugitives appear to have taken the police van. Based on the tracks on the road, I'd say they came back toward Louth."
Lockwood said, "Where are the bodies now?"
"I left them in the woods, sir."
"Go back and wait with them until help arrives."
"Yes, sir."
Lockwood rang off.
"Four dead men! My God!"
"I'm sorry, Chief Superintendent. So much for my theories about them going to ground. They're obviously here and they'll do anything to escape, including murder four of your men in cold blood."
"We have another problem. They're driving a police vehicle. To get word to the officers manning the roadblocks is going to take time. Meanwhile, your spies are dangerously close to the coast."
Lockwood walked to the map.
"Louth is here, just to the south of us. They can now take any number of secondary roads to the sea. Redeploy your men. Throw everything between Louth and the coast."
"Indeed, but it's going to take time. And your spies have a jump on us."
"One other thing," Vickery said. "Bring those dead men back here as quietly as possible. When this is all over, it may be necessary to concoct another explanation for their deaths."
"What do I tell their families?" Lockwood snapped and stormed out. Vickery picked up the telephone. The operator connected him with MI5 headquarters in London. A department operator answered. Vickery asked for Boothby and waited for him to come on the line.
"Hello, Sir Basil. I'm afraid we've got big trouble up here."
A stiff wind drove rain across the Cleethorpes waterfront as Neumann slowed and turned into a row of warehouses and garages. He stopped and shut down the motor. Dawn was not far off. In the faint light he could see a small quay
with several fishing boats tied up there, and additional boats bobbing at their moorings in the black water. They had made excellent time up the coast. Twice they had approached roadblocks, and twice they were waved through with no question, thanks to the van they were driving. Jack Kincaid's flat was supposed to be over a garage. There was a wooden exterior staircase with a door at the top. Neumann climbed out and walked up the stairs, reflexively pulling out his Mauser as he approached the door. He rapped softly, but there was no answer. He tried the latch. It was unlocked. He opened the door and walked inside. He was immediately struck by the stench of the place. Rotting rubbish, stale cigarettes, unwashed bodies, an overwhelming smell of alcohol. He tried the light switch, but nothing happened. He removed his torch from his pocket and switched it on. The beam caught the figure of a large man sleeping on a bare mattress. Neumann picked his way across the filthy room and nudged the man with the toe of his boot. "You Jack Kincaid?"
"Yeah. Who are you?"
"My name is James Porter. You're supposed to give me a lift in your boat."
"Oh, yes, yes."
Kincaid tried to sit up, but couldn't. Neumann shone the light directly into his face. He was at least 60 years old, and his craggy face showed the signs of heavy drinking. "Have a little bit to drink last night, Jack?" Neumann asked.
"A little."
"Which boat is yours, Jack?"
"The Camilla."
"Where is she exactly?"
"Down at the quay. You can't miss her."
Kincaid was passing out again. "You won't mind if I just borrow her for a bit, do you, Jack?" Kincaid didn't answer, just started snoring heavily. "Thanks awfully, Jack." Neumann went out and got back inside the van. "Our captain is in no condition to sail, drunk out of his mind."
"The boat?"
"The Camilla. He says it's right down there on the quay."
"There's something else down there."
"What's that?"
"You'll see in just a minute."
Neumann watched as a constable stepped into view. "They must be watching the entire coast," Neumann said.
"It's a shame. Another needless casualty."
"Let's get it over with. I've killed more people tonight than I did in all the time I was in the Fallschirmjäger."
"Why do you think Vogel sent you here?"
Neumann didn't respond. "What about Jenny?"
"She comes with us."
"I want to leave her here. She's no use to us now."
"I disagree. If they find her, she can tell them a great deal. And besides, if they know we have a hostage on board, they'll think twice about what steps they take to stop us."
"If you're suggesting they'll hesitate to fire on us because we have a British civilian on board, you're mistaken. There's too much at stake for that. They'll kill us all if need be."
"So be it, then. She comes with us. When we get to the submarine, we'll leave her behind on the boat. The British will rescue her, and she won't be harmed."
Neumann understood that to continue arguing would be a waste of time. Catherine turned around and, in English, said to Jenny,
"No more heroics. If you make one move, I'll shoot you in the face."
Neumann shook his head. He started the motor, dropped the van into gear, and drove down to the quay. The constable at quayside heard the sound of a motor, stopped pacing, and looked up. He spotted the police van driving toward him. Odd, he thought, since his relief was not due to arrive until 8 o'clock. He watched the van draw to a halt and saw two people getting out. He struggled to make them out in the darkness, but after a few seconds he realized they were not police officers. It was a man and a woman, very probably the fugitives. He then had a terrible sinking feeling. He was armed with only a pre-war revolver that jammed frequently. The woman was walking toward him. Her arm swung up, and there was a flash, but almost no sound, just a muffled thump. He felt the bullet tear through his chest, was aware of losing his balance. His last sight was the dirty water of the Humber rushing toward him. Ian McMahon was a fisherman who believed the pure Celtic blood flowing through his veins gave him powers mere mortals did not possess. During his 60 years living near the North Sea, he claimed to have heard distress calls before they went out. He claimed to see the ghosts of men lost at sea floating over the quays and the harbours.
He claimed to know that some vessels were haunted and would never go near them. Everyone in Cleethorpes accepted all this as truth, but in private suggested Ian McMahon had spent far too many nights at sea. McMahon had risen as usual at 5 o'clock, even though the dismal forecast promised conditions that would keep all boats off the water that day. He was eating a breakfast of porridge at the kitchen table when he heard a noise outside on the quay. The smack of the rain made it difficult to detect any other sound, but McMahon could have sworn he heard someone or something falling into the water. He knew there was a constable outside. He had taken him tea and a wedge of cake before turning in last night, and he knew why he was there. The police were looking for a pair of murder suspects from London. McMahon guessed these were not ordinary murder suspects. He had lived in Cleethorpes for 20 years, and never had he heard of the local police guarding the waterfront. The kitchen window of McMahon's cottage provided an excellent view of the quay and the mouth of the Humber beyond. McMahon rose, parted the curtains, and looked out. There was no sign of the constable. McMahon threw on an oilskin and sou'wester, took his torch from the table beside the door, and went out. He switched on his torch and started walking. After a few steps, he heard the sound of a boat's diesel motor firing and sputtering into life. He walked faster until he could see which boat it was. The Camilla, Jack Kincaid's boat. McMahon thought, is he daft, heading out in a storm like this? He started running, yelling, Jack! Jack! Stop! Where do you think you're going? Then he realized the man untying the Camilla from the quay and jumping onto the aft deck was not Jack Kincaid. Someone was stealing his boat. He looked around for the constable, but he was gone. The man stepped into the wheelhouse and opened the throttle, and the Camilla nosed away from the quay. McMahon ran forward and shouted, Come back, you! Then a second person stepped from the wheelhouse. McMahon saw a muzzle flash, but heard no sound. He felt the round whiz past his head, dangerously close. He hit the ground behind a pair of empty drums. Two more shots struck the quay, then the gunfire ended. He stood up and saw the stern of the Camilla running out to sea. Only then did McMahon see something floating in the oily water off the quay.
I think you need to hear this for yourself, Major Vickery.
Vickery took the telephone receiver Lockwood handed to him. Ian McMahon was on the line from Cleethorpes. Lockwood said,
Start from the beginning, Ian.
Two people just stole Jack Kincaid's fishing boat and are making for open water.
Vickery snapped.
My God, where are you calling from?
Cleethorpes.
Vickery squinted to see the map.
Cleethorpes? Didn't we have a man there?
You did, McMahon said.
He's floating in the water right now with a bullet through his heart.
Vickery swore softly, then said,
How many were there?
At least two that I saw.
A man and a woman?
Too far away and too dark. Besides, when they started shooting at me, I hit the dirt.
You didn't see a young girl with them?
No.
Vickery covered the mouthpiece with the palm of his hand.
Maybe she's still in that van. Get a man out there as quickly as you can.
Lockwood nodded. Vickery removed his hand and said,
Tell me about the boat they stole.
The Camilla, a fishing vessel.
The boat's in bad shape. I wouldn't want to be aboard the Camilla heading out in a blow like this.
One other question. Does the Camilla have a radio?
No, not that I know of.
Vickery thought, Thank God.
He said, Thank you for your help.
Vickery rang off. Lockwood was standing before the map.
Well, the good news is we know exactly where they are now. They have to slip through the mouth of the Humber before they can reach open water. That's only about a mile from the quay. There's no way we can stop them from doing that. But get those Royal Navy corvettes into position off Spurnhead, and they'll never make it through. That fishing boat they're in will be no match for them.
I'd feel better if we had our own boat in the water.
Actually, that can be arranged.
Really?
The Lincolnshire County Constabulary keeps a small police boat on the river, the Rebecca. She's in Grimsby now. She's not built for the open sea, but she'll do in a pinch. She's also quite a bit faster than that old fishing boat. If we get underway immediately, we should be able to overtake them before too long.
Does the Rebecca have a radio?
Aye. We'll be able to talk to you right here.
How about weapons?
I can pick up a couple of old rifles from the lockup in the Grimsby police station. They'll do the trick. Now all you need is a crew. Take my men with you. I'll stay here so I can remain in contact with London. The last thing you need is me on board a boat in weather like this. Lockwood managed a smile, clapped Vickery on the back, and went out. Clive Roach, Harry Dalton, and Peter Jordan followed him. Vickery picked up the telephone to break the news to Boothby in London. Neumann stayed between the channel markers as the Camilla sliced through the choppy waters of the mouth of the Humber. She was about 40 feet, broad in the beam and desperately in need of paint. There was a small cabin aft where Neumann had left Jenny. Catherine stood next to him in the wheelhouse. The sky was beginning to lighten slightly in the east. Rain drummed against the window. Off the port side he could see waves breaking over Spurn Head. Spurn light was blacked out. A compass was set in the dash next to the wheel. Neumann put the boat on a heading due east, opened the throttle full, and headed out to sea.